Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Monday, October 19th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. This article is entitled, Small Bites. Swenson's rebranded as Red Plate Diner. The Human Bean opens. By J.C. Lewis. The Red Plate Diner, formerly Swenson's Ice Cream and Food, recently rebranded because the owners wanted to serve more family recipes, which wasn't possible as a franchise. Owners Terry and Deanne Lynch rolled out the new brand and menu 4 weeks ago. They have owned the restaurant for 12 years, and Terry Lynch said about 8 years ago, he and his wife wanted to move away from a franchise for more opportunities to better serve the Permian Basin. There are some rules and regulations when running a franchise, and they weren't keen on letting us update the menu and refresh it. And Midland is a trendy spot, so we wanted to be able to give more food options to Midland as far as that goes, he said. Also, during the summertime, we would like to have some fruit-flavored ice creams, a variety, and Swenson's was pretty set on their ones. The restaurant has always served made-from-scratch soup, some of which are Lynch's grandmother's recipes. Swenson didn't want the Midland location offering homemade soup, so that is when they decided it was time to branch out, Lynch said. The name Red Plate Diner has some history with the restaurant. About 8 years ago, we started a thing where we have random red dishes in our mix, and if a guest happens to get their meal served on a red plate, we buy them a scoop of ice cream of their choice, he said. When we tossed around potential names, the Red Plate Diner was the one we thought conveyed best that Deanne and I are still here. And though the names changed, many of the components of our operating plan, from our world-famous service to our Red Plate bonus, will live on. The change to Red Plate Diner was delayed because of the pandemic. Lynch said he didn't want customers to think they went out of business, and they were able to do updates by making the change. He said he remains grateful to the Swenson's franchise because that is what originally got him into the restaurant business. The updated menu features Reuben sandwiches, hand-chopped and tossed salads, chicken fried steak, and a quarter-pound hot dog with chili and cheese. Lynch also rolls out dumplings for chicken and dumplings, makes old-fashioned goulash and green chili stew, along with other traditional homemade soups. We're able to infuse some good items like that, along with nachos and other items, Lynch said. More importantly, this gives us leeway that we'll be able to do a lot of things when guests say they would like something new. Red Plate Diner has Casserole Wednesday, when customers can buy a fresh casserole to take home and bake. The casseroles are $39 and feed 4 to 6 people, Lynch said. Red Plate Diner is open from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Saturday. Now open. The Human Bean, officially opened Thursday at 2007 North Big Spring Street. 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. 7 days a week. This month's special is the Raspberry Frost, a chocolate and raspberry treat which can be hot, iced, or blended. Proceeds from all drinks and food items purchased on Friday will be donated to provide mammograms for low-income women and post-diagnosis support for Breast Cancer Awareness Month, according to an Instagram post. The drink menu consists of espressos, frozen drinks, a Mexican mocha, real fruit smoothies. Pumpkin flavor can be added to any drink. Just announced. Far West Coffee has finished construction and set its grand opening for 6 to 10 p.m. Friday. Then the shop will be open 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Saturday, starting October 26th. Co-owner Christopher Benninghoff said the shop will have oat-chata and cold brew on tap. The shop will be offering teas, drip coffees, and small pastries. Benninghoff said he is planning on adding food options early next year. Dead End Food Shack is now serving Sunday brunch. The Detour Bar is open and indoor seating is available, along with outdoor seating on the patio. The brunch menu features a dead-end Laws sandwich, which has a beet bun, caper and dill cream cheese, cucumber onion, spinach, and smoked salmon served with potatoes. A chorizo hatch, which has chorizo, potatoes, jalapenos, onion, cilantro, beans, two eggs, and shredded cheese served with two corn tortillas. A menudo, a spicy Mexican beef tripe soup with onion lime and toasted bread. Mimosas, Bloody Marys, and other alcoholic beverages are available through the Detour Bar. Brunch is served from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, October 24, 2020. Halloween happenings. Cinema Under the Stars features Rocky Horror Picture Show by J.C. Lewis. jc.lewis@hearstnp.com. Traditional Halloween plans might be changed because of the pandemic, but there are plenty of opportunities to celebrate this year, including Drive Boo at the Midland County Public Library Downtown Branch and Cinema Under the Stars at Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Fall Festival, Drive Boo, Trunk or Treat, Drive-Through Trunk or Treat is 4 to 6 p.m. today at the MCPL Downtown Branch. Visitors must enter from Missouri Avenue and remain in their cars. Bring bags for volunteers and library staff to fill with treats. Volunteers and staff will be wearing masks and practicing social distancing. Cinema Under the Stars with Hocus Pocus and Rocky Horror Picture Show is Thursday at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Hocus Pocus starts at 8 p.m. Tickets are $5 and can be bought at bit.ly/cinema20hocuspocus. Rocky Horror Picture Show starts at 11 p.m. Tickets are $5 and can be purchased at bit.ly/cinema20rockyfb. Patrons may wear costumes representing characters from the movies. The city is hosting Halloween Fest 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday at the Martin Luther King Jr. Park, 2300 Butternut Lane. The 8th annual event will feature local businesses handing out treats. There won't be any games this year in order to keep a steady flow of traffic. Prizes will be given for the best decorated booth. Bloody Bill's Haunted Maze Chainsaw Carnage is 7 p.m. to midnight today, Friday, and October 31, at 2215 West 2nd Street in Odessa. Tickets are $15 per person or $20 for line skip. The Haunted Maze will feature zombie rednecks, psycho rodeo clowns, and crazed cannibals. Live Rooftop Art Show Halloween Edition is 6 to 11 p.m. Friday at Doubletree by Hilton Midland Plaza. There will be live art, a costume contest, best horror makeup contest, food and drinks. Mama Movement Halloween Costume Party is 3 p.m. Friday at the Little Gym. The event is open and free to the public. Monster Mash Jump Bash is 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. October 31 at Altitude Trampoline Park in Odessa. There will be costume contests, Halloween games, prizes, and giveaways. Tickets are $15.95 per person for 3 hours of jumping. Tickets can be purchased at altitudeodessa.com. First Baptist Church is hosting Family Fest 3 p.m. October 31. There will be carnival games, trunk or treat, prizes, and cool cars. The event is free. Petroleum Museum is presenting Grossology Family Science Night to Go. Grossology will have families experimenting with puking pumpkins, goblin snot, disappearing ghosts, ghost rockets, bubbling witch's brew, wizard potion, bone bridges, eyeball catapults, and more. A Grossology box is free. Families can register for one at pbpetro.org/family-science-night. Facebook Live experiments will begin at 2:15 p.m. on the Petroleum Museum's Facebook page. Thriving United's Angel Haven Halloween Party is 4 p.m. Friday at 501 North Lorraine Street. The event, which features a carnival and costume contest, is a fundraiser for the nonprofit. West Tex Urgent Care at 210 West Longview is hosting Trunk or Treat 3 to 5 p.m. October 31 in the West parking lot. Midland Bible Church's Country Fair is 5:30 to 8 p.m. October 31 at 5900 Whitman Drive. The third annual event will feature food and game booths, inflatables, and candy. Register at midlandbible.churchcenter.com/registrations/events/303453. Seven Cities Church Trunk or Treat is 5 to 7 p.m. October 31 at 5110 West Illinois Avenue. The event will be presented by the Reapers Car and Truck Club, Truck and Dolls, and Alterado Performance Team. Permian Basin CPR, 1601 West Texas Avenue, is hosting a Halloween party and open house 2 to 6 p.m. The event will feature games and treats for kids with coupons and prizes for teens and adults. Bernie's Italian Ice will provide free treats to the first 100 guests. Solid Rock Fellowship Out West is hosting Harvest Festival, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. October 31. There will be food, games, music, and a bounce house. Monster Mash starts 11 a.m. October 31 at Woody's Hideaway. There will be drink specials, including $5 Jeeper Creeper and $6 Deadhead cocktails. Booze and Booze Halloween Party starts 11 a.m. October 31 at Little Woodrow's. Attendees can show their best costumes featuring a face mask, and winners will be announced at midnight to receive a prize. Costume contest starts at 11 p.m. with spooky drink specials all night. Halloween Symposium to focus on witches, warlocks, and wizards. From Staff Reports. Odessa. The third annual Halloween Symposium on Literature, Lore, and More is scheduled for October 31 at the University of Texas Permian Basin. This year's theme is Witches, Warlocks, and Wizards. Students and scholars will present papers on witches, from La Llorona to Disney, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The video conference symposium will feature presentations such as The New Coven, Digital Witchcraft in the Age of the Pandemic, as found through TikTok and Baby Witches. The conference will be entirely online. Up to 250 people can join through Microsoft Teams. Link to presentations, https://tinyurl.com/yxh37jxq. The schedule of presentations is as follows. 10 a.m. Independent Scholar Amelia French, The New Coven, Digital Witchcraft in the Age of Pandemic. 10:20 a.m. UTPB Professor Rebecca Day Babcock, William Seabrook's Witches and Their Relevances in the World Today. 10:40 a.m. UTPB Professor Mariana Franzen Erazzo, Witchcraft and Reality. 11 a.m. UTPB Professor Chelsea Delaney, Representation of Disney Witches from the Evil Queen to the Snow Queen. The cold never bothered them anyway. 11:20 a.m. University of Toronto Professor Emily von Garon, Mother Houses and House Mothers, The Architecture of the Witch in Argento's Lettres Madrid. 11:40 a.m. UTPB Professor Jennifer Paxton, Curanderismo, Magical Healing. Noon, UTPB Professor Maximilian Wies, Un Espíritu Familiar, El Cuerpo por Aura de Carlos Fuentes, The Body Uncanny, Witchery Within Carlos Fuentes' Aura. 12:20 p.m., UTPB Professor Kate Ellen Edgar, A History of the Witch's Hat. 12:40 a.m., UTPB Professor Boni Martinez, Saving the Weeping Woman and Aristotelian Rhetoric to Prevent Infanticide and Abortion. Plethora of Possibilities. Costumer Crystal Wilkerson Diaz holds a headdress and feather feature of a showgirl costume Friday at Midland Community Theater Costume Rental Shop. MCT is renting Halloween costumes. By J.C. Lewis. jc.lewis@hurstnp.com. Midland Community Theater's Costume Rental Shop is now open by appointment. Costumer Crystal Wilkerson Diaz said, "The shop usually rents out about 100 costumes during the Halloween season, but this year has been slower because of the pandemic. Staff will disinfect before and after people come by to try on costumes," she said. Rental fees start at $35, with a $60 deposit. Specialty rentals are $55, with a $120 deposit. Deposits are refunded if costumes are returned in the same condition as they were rented, she said. Costumes that are available include Marilyn Monroe, Easter Bunny, military style, and flappers, as well as from the production of Mamma Mia. Some costumes have matching masks, Wilkerson Diaz said. Ready to rent? Midland Community Theater's Costume Rentals Shop, 682-2400, extension 107. Costume rental at mctmidland.org.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday. Start with trust. Spooktacular Halloween Tips by Heather Massey, Regional Director of the Better Business Bureau in the Permian Basin. Dealing with COVID-19 in 2020 has been more trick than treat. The pandemic has forced us to adjust our everyday lives, cancel plans, and wonder how to observe upcoming holidays safely. With Halloween approaching and local governments encouraging social distancing over social gatherings, many are looking for creative new ways to enjoy fall festivities. The Centers for Disease Control, CDC, is sharing both low-risk ways to celebrate and high-risk activities to avoid. Decorating your home, carving pumpkins, and virtual costume contests are deemed spooktacular, but frightful activities include visiting haunted houses, trick-or-treating, and traveling to fall festivals in other towns. Data from a recent National Retail Federation, NRF, survey shows consumers will be partaking in more individual activities such as pumpkin carving and dressing up their pets, and fewer group events like costume parties. Although the survey results expect a rise in personal spending, there are plenty of ways to celebrate while keeping your wallet happy. Sink your fangs into those scary good Halloween savings tips from your Better Business Bureau. Set a budget. The NRF estimates individuals will spend more than $90 on Halloween this year, but you may decide that's too much, or maybe not enough. Determining your budget ahead of time can help you stay on track while you shop. Search for savings. Since your favorite costumes and decorations can likely be found at more than one place, take time to comparison shop and see which retailer has the best prices. Signing up for email distribution lists from your favorite stores can offer additional savings by sending you coupons and advertisements for upcoming sales. Shop at home. Check your closets for more than just monsters. Using costumes and decorations from previous years can save money. Creating costumes with household items is another way to save money and have fun. Be smart online. Online shopping is the safest way to buy costumes, decorations, and candy this year. Before you buy, review retailers' return policies and ensure websites are secure by looking for the lock icon next to the URL. Always pay with a credit card in case you need to dispute a charge.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Monday, October 26, 2020. This article is entitled, Juju's Kitchen is Dream Come True for Chef, by J.C. Lewis. The former executive chef at Racquet Club now has his own restaurant, Juju's Kitchen. Chef Kenneth Terry and his wife Desiree opened the restaurant at the end of August at Claydesta Plaza. Terry, who was at Racquet Club for 16 years, is known as Chef Juju, hence the name of the restaurant. He and Desiree have been married for 17 years. She is a lifelong Midlander. He moved here when he was 16. My husband has always wanted to open his own restaurant, said Desiree. I'm just a loving wife that said, let's open a restaurant during a pandemic. The latte factory previously occupied the space that is now Juju's, and the previous owners put in swing seating, Desiree said. Juju's Kitchen also has seating available in the atrium of Claydesta. She said dinner time has been a little slow, but they are hoping business will pick up once they begin serving beer and wine. We are working on getting our beer and wine permit, Desiree said. We are going to roll out a happy hour permit menu when the beer and wine permit arrives. The Terrys have applied for the permit and are hoping to receive it in a couple of weeks. The menu features a variety of made-from-scratch items, including Parmesan zucchini chips, Texas cheesesteak, a Midlander burger, Nana's chicken salad, and a BYO grilled cheese, for which customers can choose from Munster, Swiss, cheddar, or American cheese on wheat berry bread. The breakfast menu features different breakfast sandwiches, chicken and waffles, Papa's Amigos with corn tortillas, fried eggs, marinated steak, black beans, pico de gallo with avocado, and Texas hash with beer-braised brisket, shredded potatoes, bell peppers, onions, fried egg, and hollandaise sauce. Kenneth enjoys the Cubanos, which has braised mojo-style pork, smoked ham, jalapeno, mustard, pickles, Swiss cheese, pressed bolillo bread, and is served with chips. Desiree, who is a vegetarian, likes the different salads with homemade salad dressing. Salads on the menu include a crunchy Thai salad, New Mexican salad, Cobber salad, Arizonan salad, and Texas salad. The restaurant also has to-go options available, such as salads and sandwiches. We offer fresh food, and it's a great atmosphere, Kenneth said. Just announced. The Museum of the Southwest annual Rain Beer in-person fundraising event has been canceled, but members can buy a Rain Beer party box for $75. For more information, go to mrt.com. Tall City Brewing Company received part of its canning line on Friday. The brewery announced October 2nd on its Facebook page that they will start canning beer. Midland Half Acre is moving from 4401 North Big Spring Street to 1101 Washita, according to MMCH Half Acre's Facebook. The last day on North Big Spring was Friday. For updates, visit facebook.com/MMC Half Acre. The Rig restaurant will bring gourmet tacos, sliders, and a full bar on Starboard Drive near Woody's Hideaway and Toro's Cafe. The Midland City Council on Tuesday passed the first reading of an ordinance for a specific use designation that will allow the sale of alcohol at the property, according to a previous report from the Reporter-Telegram. The ordinance needs a second reading to be approved.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Sunday, October 25, 2020. Viewpoints. Biden sends message to oil industry. You're done. Stuart Doreen, sdoreen@hearstmp.com. I would transition from the oil industry, yes. Joe Biden, the Democratic Party's nominee for president, said it. No hydraulic fracturing on federal lands, and for the rest of us, it is time for a transition. Oh, Midland, your days are numbered. I don't believe in endorsements. They rarely serve a purpose. For a newspaper, the better use of its time is the dissemination of information. And the information about the debate last week is clear. Biden and the party he represents want to eliminate what we do in Midland and inside the Permian Basin. Democrats want to punish West Texans and make liars of industry leaders who have said production would take place for decades. Democrats don't want the revenue that has filled the state coffers to fund education and transportation. They don't want the high-paying jobs that allow all West Texans to have opportunities that wouldn't be possible along the I-35 corridor. The opportunity here gets in the way of the Democratic Party fulfilling its mission. It's true of Democratic leaders across the state and nation. They march in lockstep. Think about that when you go to the ballot box. Democrats, you see, are on the record about their intentions, and their party's leader removed all doubt in front of tens of millions of people. The oil industry will go by the way of coal. Democrats believe it has to. Oil is not part of a climate change agenda, and for that reason, and that reason alone, it is time for communities like Midland and others that dot the West Texas landscape to wither and die. The glass-half-full approach is that Midland isn't located in southeast New Mexico. With a hydraulic fracturing ban in place for federal lands, a certainty under a Biden presidency, The demise of the industry in that part of New Mexico will be quicker and more certain. But make no mistake about it, Democratic rule would eventually set its sights on West Texas and the heart of one of the world's largest and most significant oil patches. There will be some in the Democratic Party who relish the idea of sticking it to an area where conservatism is held in such high esteem and tens of millions of dollars have been donated to Republican candidates. But the reality is this wouldn't be personal for them. It is strictly about the elimination of an industry that many in the Democratic Party and the far left of the political spectrum hold in contempt. And if that results in the ruin of a region and the hundreds of thousands of people who live there, well, that is collateral damage. And this is just part of the Democratic Party's nominee plan to transition from the energy industry.
This is the opinion page. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, It's Time to Change the Way Texans Pick Appellate Judges, by Grace Shimin, President of the League of Women Voters of Texas, and Joanne Richards, Chair of Texans for Fair Courts, Austin American Statesman. Can you name one member of the Texas Supreme Court or the Court of Criminal Appeals? Any judge belonging to one of the 14 regional courts of appeals? If you can't, you're not alone. The vast majority of Texans either didn't vote for candidates running for these judgeships, or they did vote, but for a candidate they knew little or nothing about. Wallace Jefferson, former Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, wrote in 2019 in the Houston Chronicle, "You don't know who I am. I don't blame you. I have been on the statewide ballot three times, in 2002, 2006, and 2008. I was elected each time by impressive margins. Yet a July 2008 statewide poll found that 86% of the electorate never heard of me. I won because Texans voted for Rick Perry, Kay Bailey Hutchison, and John McCain." With seven seats between Texas's two highest courts up for election this November, the future of Texans is at stake right now. Ensuring that our judiciary system is composed of qualified, impartial judges is necessary to securing the rights of Texas's voters, workers, business owners, and community members. But that becomes difficult if Texans continue to elect appellate judges they know little about. It's time for a change. The Texas Commission on Judicial Selection is meeting now to discuss a wide variety of election and appointment systems and will make recommendations to Governor Greg Abbott and the legislature. Texas is one of only six states that still select their judges in partisan elections. This partisan election system is precisely why party affiliation carries such an outsized importance in deciding who ends up behind the bench in our state. And although there is no perfect judicial selection method, there must be a better system than our current one. One alternative is to select judges based on merit. This method, currently used by 23 states, gives a nonpartisan nominating commission the responsibility of reviewing public input and evaluating the qualifications of judicial candidates, including their competence, fairness, and integrity. The commission then makes appointment recommendations to the governor. It's worth noting that many of these merit-based systems include retention elections so that the voters can hold judges accountable. How does our current system of electing judges stack up against a merit-based system? In a word, poorly. Because voters have so little information about judicial candidates, voters often select judges based on their political affiliation, calling into question the impartiality of the court. And because the top of the ticket often influences down-ballot races, Texans often lose out on highly qualified judges. Moreover, because judicial candidates must raise money to campaign in our election system, the appearance of the money influencing their decision-making is hard to shake. A merit-based selection process would insulate state courts from political influences by selecting judges based on merit, not political allegiance or affiliation. Many asked, how are nominating commissioners chosen? Who makes the final selection of judges? These questions are important as the devil's in the details. Among the states using merit-based selection, the fairness of the different systems varies tremendously. An unfair merit-based system that gives too much discretion to the governor, partisans, or other special interests could be much worse than our current system. It's the job of the Texas Commission on Judicial Selection to sort through many of these differences, avoid conflicts of interest, and find the right system for Texas. There may be no perfect system of judicial selection, but it's clear that Texas has plenty of room to improve. Texans deserve a fair and impartial judiciary, one that is beholden to the rule of the law, not wealthy special interests. We call on the Commission to find the best way to make that a reality. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This column is entitled "Money Counts, But So Does Timing" by Ross Ramsey, Texas Tribune. Late money is pouring into M.J. Hager's campaign for the U.S. Senate, and the Texas Tribune's Patrick Svitek reported last week that the Democrat has jumped ahead of Republican incumbent John Cornyn in money raised, money on hand, and this is the important bit, advertising presence. Hager remains behind in the polls, even as that contest and others appear to be tightening, as they will as Election Day approaches. But there is a number buried in those polls of particular interest. A lot of Texans haven't formed an opinion of her, either positive or negative. That's the kind of information political campaigns are built on. For a candidate, it's a sign that introductions are in order, that voters need to know more before they'll sign up and lend their support and their votes. For the opposition, it's the possibility that voters might be susceptible to negative information, a chance to introduce an opponent in a negative way, in the hope that a bad first impression will tilt the race your way. Money is how you do those things, especially in the expansive mediaverse of Texas, a state notorious for the expense of running effective advertising campaigns. There's a reason the presidential commercials have been relatively restrained here. It's less expensive to reach voters in smaller states and more efficient to contend for electoral college votes in those places. Hager started the general election campaign with some serious disadvantages. First, the pandemic extended the primary runoffs, and Hager's Democratic runoff required time and money she'd rather have spent getting ready for November. The signs of that late start showed in the mid-year campaign finance reports. Hager got to that point with $900,000 in the bank, while Cornyn, who was finished with his primary in March, had $14.5 million. That put him on the airwaves earlier than Hager. The Democrat caught up during the third quarter, outraising Cornyn $14 million to $7.2 million and reaching October with money to advertise and campaign for the rest of the race. And she's getting outside help from Democratic groups looking to knock off one of the Republican leaders in the U.S. Senate. Better late than never. But wouldn't it have been great to introduce yourself before so many of the state's registered voters had started casting their ballots? With what appears to be a financial advantage in the final days, Hager might well gain some ground on Cornyn. But it's not like most of us are waiting till Election Day to vote. In fact, many of the votes have already been cast. It would be fun to know, though it would also be impossible to find out, how the voting went on each day from the start of early voting through Election Day. It would be one way of telling whether and how the information that dropped between those dates changed voters' minds. Did the ads work? Did debates, gaffes, promises, news, or whatever change public opinion? A lot has happened already this month. Maybe voters' opinion in the presidential race weren't in flux. It seems like almost everybody decided a long time ago whether they want to stay the course or change direction. But in other races on the ballot, from Cornyn and Hager all the way down to local school board trustees, late information has been known to sway voters. That's why they advertise, to say nice things about their own campaigns and not so nice things about the opposition. There's more competition for voter attention as we get closer to November 3rd. early money is coveted by campaigns because it lets them start their campaigns earlier before the noise level is so high. They can establish their candidate's public image before the other side gets a chance to do it. It doesn't always work, but it's hard to argue that a later start is just as good. The U.S. Senate race in Texas is a test of sorts. Hager hasn't run a statewide campaign before. Cornyn has run six, starting in 1990, three for the U.S. Senate, not including the current race, one for Texas Attorney General, and two for the Texas Supreme Court. Many of the state's voters weren't yet born when he first appeared on a statewide ballot. He's better known. He started with more money. She has more money now. He had more ads on TV. Now she does. That's not all there is to this race. There's plenty of racket in the contest at the top of the ballot that could affect the Senate outcome. But it has the makings of a political case study. Cornyn got the jump, financially speaking. Hager took the finish. What worked better? This column is entitled "Trump Acts Like Someone Who Knows He's Losing" by Megan McArdle, Washington Post Writers Group. It's hard to say whether it was the addition of a mute button that held President Donald Trump back in the first part of Thursday's debate, or whether his own advisors finally convinced him that overbearing jerk was not a winning political persona. Either way, Trump turned in a better, saner, more restful performance than in the first debate. Better late than ever, of course. But I'm not sure how much better, given how much ground he has to make up with less than 2 weeks to go. After the humbling experience of 2016, I am loath to proclaim Joseph R. Biden the next president of the United States. What I do feel confident in saying is, first, as Ross Douthat of the New York Times has already pointed out, that Trump acts like someone who is trying to lose the election, haphazardly flitting from message to message without any coherent, overarching theme. And second, that Trump acts like someone who knows he is losing. The first tell came during the debate last month with Biden, when Trump was asked about the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court and responded, "We have plenty of time, even if we did it after the election itself. I have a lot of time after the election, you know." These are not the words of a confident warrior. They are the words of a man who has already begun contemplating a lame duck end to his first term. The latest signs came when he preemptively started attacking Thursday's moderator, whom he had earlier praised. It was hard not to suspect that Trump was just looking for a scapegoat in advance to justify a failure he was already anticipating. There was a moment in the debate when it seemed Trump might save himself. "We have to open our country," he said. "I've said it often, the cure cannot be worse than the problem itself, and that's what's happening." It looked as if Trump was prepared to spend 90 minutes having a semi-serious discussion about serious topics, such as the trade-offs we're making to control the pandemic. But he couldn't keep it up. By the end of the debate, he reverted to form, taunting Biden to say it, about a $15 minimum wage, and trying to dodge questions about race in America by changing the topic to Hunter Biden's adventures abroad. This only brought home what Trump makes obvious every day. He is not the n-dimensional chess player of conservative legend. In fact, he isn't even able to correctly perceive his own personal self-interest, which complicates his sales pitch, even to conservatives. 4 years ago, Trump's opponents within the conservative movement pointed out that Trump was an unprincipled con man. This argument didn't work well because, of course, his supporters knew that his affected Christianity was not merely new, but breathtakingly shallow, that he had no firm ideological commitments, that he would slap his name on anything, no matter how cheap or sleazy, and that he stiffed his vendors whenever he thought he could get away with it. So what, his supporters said. They didn't need to trust him. All they needed was for him to understand that if he didn't deliver on policy, they'd demolish him at the next election. This allegedly hard-nosed realism, in fact, contained a heroic and untested assumption: that Trump would understand what his political incentives were. Trump has spent the past year systematically falsifying that hypothesis. It didn't take a scientific genius to understand in early March that the United States had been handed a very lucky break. We'd been seeded with COVID-19 later than Europe, so if we acted quickly, we could escape relatively lightly. It didn't require an economist to understand that pandemics are bad for the economy, particularly if you let them get out of control. It didn't require any great altruist to know that voters don't like dying. No, it just took someone of ordinary judgment and modest cunning to grasp that the president's best chance for re-election was coherent, consistent leadership on COVID-19, instead of alternately claiming the virus was going away on its own and ranting about miracle cures like some late-night huckster on a third-rate cable channel. Unfortunately, we didn't have someone like that in the Oval Office. We just had Trump. Which is why it looks like we'll have Trump for only a few months longer. Republicans may lose the Senate thanks to their decision to stand behind their president. His party faction will pay a price too, as the rest of the party blames them for the debacle. That faction will be fighting to place the blame elsewhere, on a stab in the back from establishment types, on the biased media, on anyone except the guy who deserves it most, the self-proclaimed genius who couldn't even beat sleepy Joe Biden. This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Monday, October 19th, 2020. This is the opinion page. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, In Forecasting Trump versus Biden, Two Forecasts Predict Different Outcomes, by Jonathan Kilov, Austin American Statesman. In September 2016, I wrote a story about political forecasts at a time when, as Bob Dylan put it, you didn't need a weatherman to know which way the wind was blowing. I focused on two forecasts. One was by the University of Texas political scientist Christopher Vleeson and his colleague Robert Erickson of Columbia University. Their model, based on polling averages and leading economic indicators, had predicted the correct winner since they first devised it in 1992. They predicted that Hillary Clinton had a 76% chance of winning the popular vote, and that in a two-party race, Clinton would defeat Donald Trump 52.2% to 47.8%. At the time, that sounded about right. I also focused on the forecast of Helmut Norpoth, at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, whose model, based on historical election cycles and very selective primary results, correctly predicted the winner of the popular vote in all five presidential elections since it debuted in 1996. Norpoth put the likelihood of a Trump victory at 87%. In his forecast, Trump and Clinton switched places, with Trump defeating Clinton 52.5% to 47.5%. Some found Norpoth's 2016 forecast disturbing. People told him, I'm sure you're wrong, or I hope you're wrong. It's hard not to be a little shaky about it, Norpoth told me then. Trump certainly is doing a lot of things up to this point that might make me a little nervous. As it turned out, Norpoth was wrong. Vleeson and Erickson were right. Clinton won the popular vote, though by a far narrower margin than they predicted. On Thursday, PS, Political Science and Politics, a quarterly academic journal, released its 2020 Presidential Election Forecasting Symposium, featuring a dozen forecasts, including by Vleeson and Erickson and Northrop, both this time taking account of the Electoral College. Our model, based on trial heat polls and cumulative growth in LEI, leading economic indicators, forecasts a popular victory for Joe Biden over Donald Trump, and by an ample margin to avoid worries of an electoral college upset, Vleeson and Erickson wrote. The pandemic, they say, shifted our forecasts substantially, turning a slight Biden advantage into a large one. But the authors also note that they cannot anticipate how changes in the conduct of elections will affect turnout and vote counting itself. This adds to the uncertainty surrounding our forecast. Norpoth returns with an electoral college forecast built on his usual construct. He gives Trump a 91% chance of winning re-election. Trump is predicted to get 362 electoral votes, Biden 176. To be sure, the forecast of a near-certain Trump victory strains credulity, Norpoth writes. Polls have shown Trump trailing Biden in the Real Clear Politics average every day of this election year thus far. This, of course, feels eerily familiar. In 2016, polls and poll aggregation forecasts projected a nearly insurmountable lead for Hillary Clinton. But Norpoth stands by his model, which relies on the outcomes of the New Hampshire and South Carolina primaries and electoral college results from 1826 to 2016. Looking at the latter, he writes, "One can spot roughly 10 cycles with the naked eye, which translates into a cycle length of about 20 years. In other words, from 1826 to 2016, a party held the White House for about 10 years, on average. That is, between 2 and 3 terms. To capitalize on this swing of the electoral pendulum for forecasting, I borrowed an algorithm invented by the British statistician Yule in the 1920s to gauge cycles in sunspots. It is worth noting that the sunspot series over 2 centuries bears an eerie resemblance to the electoral series. Electoral analysis, after all, has more in common with astronomy than astrology. Either way, I guess, our fate is in the stars." This column is entitled "Working from Home is Here to Stay" by Noah Smith, Bloomberg. The COVID-19 pandemic has crushed the economy, sent joblessness soaring, and killed over 1 million people worldwide. But there are a few ways in which the pandemic may prompt society to improve, and one is remote work. Though it was initially necessary to keep employees from getting sick, remote work promises to make people more productive and happier while helping the environment and preserving infrastructure. When the coronavirus struck, those who could do their jobs remotely often did. The number has gradually declined as our understanding of safety measures increased, but it's still substantial. And while many people will go back to the office after the pandemic is over, part of the shift will probably be permanent. A recent survey shows a substantial increase in the number of workers who say they won't go back to the office full time. There are certainly drawbacks to the remote trend. Those working from home are far more likely to be in higher income professional occupations, such as engineers, lawyers, financiers, or consultants. Most lower income jobs can't be done remotely, such as in food service and brick and mortar retail. That's created inequality in terms of both unemployment and exposure to COVID-19. And when high-income workers become accustomed to staying home and ordering online instead of going out to eat and shop, it's lower-earning local service workers who bear the brunt of the shift in demand. The trend has also taken a psychological toll. People who work remotely often end up putting in more hours than when they go into the office. With the boundary between job and home life blurred, there's no obvious signal that it's okay to stop working, which can make it hard to relax. As any graduate student or entrepreneur can attest, the nagging anxiety of whether you should be working more can easily lead to burnout. But there are good reasons to think that these negative effects will mostly be transitory. As countries that have dealt successfully with COVID-19 show, engineers and lawyers will go back to restaurants and shop at stores when the pandemic is over. While a few industries, such as movie theaters, may suffer permanent decline, home delivery is not a true substitute for most retail experiences. Psychological stress will probably also ebb as the coronavirus threat eases. People who work remotely will develop strategies to segment their jobs from their personal lives and budget their time in ways that leave them less anxious. Professors, writers, and other people whose jobs have always been semi-remote show that this can be done. And most workers will eventually alternate between home and the office. This kind of part-time remote work promises to bring substantial benefits to society. Flexibility will add to work-life balance. If a working parent needs to stay home to take care of a sick child or supervise home repairs, they'll be able to do that without sacrificing income or productivity. Vacations will be easier too. Remote work could even increase productivity by reducing the number of hours wasted by people trying to look busy for their bosses. Remote work will also benefit American society economically. Fewer days in the office means less time spent commuting. A recent blog posted by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis looked at falling commute times in three suburban counties and calculated that about 1 million to 1.5 million hours were probably saved in each county between April and July. Going forward, the amount saved will be less, but still substantial. Long commutes are associated with unhappiness, so more days spent working at home will make for an emotionally healthier populace. It will also save workers money and reduce wear and tear on the nation's crumbling road infrastructure. Reduced greenhouse emissions will be yet another plus. To maximize the benefits from the shift to remote work, government policy should aim to ease the transition. Since more people will be toiling out of their houses instead of an office building, cities should change zoning codes to facilitate conversion to commercial real estate to residential. Government can also subsidize service workers to move to new neighborhoods to follow high-income jobs, since that's where the new demand will be. It can also help retrain people displaced by long-term shifts in demand, such as the decline of movie theaters. And it can gather information from big companies that successfully managed to shift to partial remote work and share those strategies with small businesses that might otherwise have a tougher time managing the transition. In the long run, especially with smart policies, more flexible work arrangements will be a good thing. COVID-19 has wreaked terrible damage on society, but in this small way, it will end up moving things in a healthier direction.
This is the medical advice column to Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Dear Dr. Roach, do you find in your practice that normal A1C for non-diabetics changes with age? Answer. The hemoglobin A1C is a measure of how much sugar is on a hemoglobin molecule. Blood sugar will attach to hemoglobin, and the more sugar in the blood, the more that will become bound to hemoglobin over the lifetime of a red blood cell. The A1C then provides a very good, but not perfect, guide to blood sugar over the past 2 to 3 months. The A1C is not reliable in people with abnormal or unusual hemoglobin types, or in people with a condition of increased breakdown of blood cells. As people get older, their ability to respond to a sugar load decreases. For a person without diabetes, this relative inability to metabolize sugar has little significance, but it does make the average A1C increase somewhat with age. Even though the average A1C increases with age, the normal A1C remains as defined, independent of age, less than 5.7%. Clearly, more people will be diagnosed with diabetes, nearly all type 2 diabetes, as they age.
Grandparents have no idea while they're out in the cold. Dear Abby for Thursday. Dear Abby, my brother Brian and his wife Laurel have an adult son, Dick, who dated a girl I'll call Crystal for 10 years before they got married. Everyone got along fine until Crystal gave birth. After their first child was born, Crystal started withholding visits from my brother and his wife. Crystal and Dick had 2 more children. The oldest is now 6. The only way Brian and Laurel see their grandchildren is if there is a family reunion, wedding, etc. Crystal allows her parents to see the kids and spend time with them whenever. Brian and Laurel are flabbergasted by what has happened. They have no idea why all of a sudden after giving birth, their DIL has not allowed them to visit the grandkids, babysit, or anything. My brother and his wife are great people. They don't drink to excess or use drugs and would be wonderful grandparents for those children. Would it be appropriate as a family member, aunt, to write a letter to Crystal and in a kind, non-accusatory way, explain the hurt this has caused and how much their children are missing out from not being around these two great individuals? Missing out in Oregon. Dear Missing Out, while it isn't unheard of for the wife's parents to take precedence over the husband's, Crystal's behavior does appear to be extreme. It also appears the way she's acting is retaliatory. But the people who must get to the bottom of it are your brother and his wife. I don't think there's anything to be gained by involving yourself in this sad mess, because if you do, Crystal and her husband will resent it. Sympathize, but stay out of it. Dear Abby, 5 years ago, my daughter Angie and her two children moved in with me after she and her husband separated. I hoped she would get her finances and life together and be able to get a place of her own. What I didn't realize at the time was that Angie had started a relationship and had fallen in love with a man she met online. Her daughter was very upset about it. Angie was in a custody dispute over her youngest child, and we disagreed more than once about issues concerning the children. After a couple of years, she moved into her own place. She's still involved with this individual. I haven't met him and have no desire to. She's upset with me because of it. I don't want to see him with her because he has been married several times and is involved with drugs. I realize who Angie is involved with is her business and not mine, but I want nothing to do with him. How can I avoid a rift with her over this? Soward in South Carolina. Dear Soward, no law says you have to meet this person, and it is your privilege to avoid him if you wish. I'm not sure what your daughter expects from you. Does she want you to entertain him? Common sense would dictate that you do not want anyone who is involved with illegal substances in your home. However, I do think you should agree to meet him once. If Angie's relationship with you is predicated on the idea that you will welcome this individual into your life with open arms, because she has, you will then have to figure out how to navigate this. That she would allow someone like him to interact with her children shows very poor judgment. Write Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
Jacqueline Bigger Stars by Madeline Aslan. The stars are the kind of day you'll have. 5 dynamic, 4 positive, 3 average, 2 so-so, 1 difficult. A baby born today has a sun in Scorpio and a moon in Aries. Happy birthday for Thursday, October 29, 2020. Persuasive, thorough, and influential, you come to your work with fresh ideas. Many of you possess an exceptional ability, and this year, by staying humble, you do extremely well. Beware of disloyalty from a professional faux friend. If single, love comes to the rescue, and a healthy and loving relationship begins in the spring. If attached, stay so. An old flame can reignite, but a past pattern repeats. Virgo grounds you. Aries, March 21 through April 19. 5 stars. Today your charm and beauty impress the right people and help is offered. Pursue social and professional opportunities. Tremendous mental energy and artistic aptitude are heightened. New ideas abound. A friend is helpful and has knowledge to share. Tonight, dance like no one's watching. Taurus, April 20 through May 20. 4 stars. Take time for quiet reflection today. Explore your subconscious needs through meditation and dream analysis. A person from the past unexpectedly gets in touch. You will be glad. Helping others who are less fortunate brings you joy. Tonight, a good night's sleep. Gemini, May 21 through June 20. 4 stars. Today emphasizes help, charity, and wellness. A reunion of some type can be planned. Goals crystallize. Healing and growth are due. A larger-than-life quality prevails. But stay grounded and keep a perspective. Seek efficiency. Tonight, involvement on Zoom with a large group. Cancer, June 21 through July 22. 4 stars. Be a good listener. You might learn a lot. today creates a limiting and somewhat frustrating career situation. Accept others as they are and use your creative ideas constructively. By the end of the day, recognition is yours. Tonight, celebrate with older family members. Leo, July 23 through August 22. 5 stars. Today brings a cycle of great insight and awareness. Discussion groups and an eclectic combination of cultural traditions awaken your higher mind. Studying another language can have a positive impact, too. Tonight, watch a foreign movie or documentary. Virgo, August 23 through September 22. 5 stars. An old demon no longer troubles you. Inwardly, you'll feel more peaceful and strong. New financial strategies are worth considering. Your legendary analytical ability is in top form, enabling you to find solutions to several pesky problems. Tonight, a sigh of relief. Libra, September 23 through October 22. 3 stars. Be lighthearted about partnerships today. Today doesn't favor a serious or committed situation. Use caution in making promises and select closest associates with care. Trust your own instincts if a project of time investment seems risky. Tonight, vulnerable to peer pressure. Scorpio, October 23 through November 21. 3 stars. Today accents domestic relationships. Be alert to the needs of beloved pets. They'll be especially sensitive and emotional. Also with any help or assistance you hire and use. Companions surprise you with progressive plans. Tonight, a marvelous cycle for decision-making. Sagittarius, November 22 through December 21. 5 stars. Your charisma is at a peak, and interesting new prospects are attracted to you. Genuine drama is followed by the fireworks clearing. A companion whom you've lost track of can resurface. Tonight, double-check all agreements for questions of propriety come into play. Capricorn, December 22 through January 19. 4 stars. Work hard and be patient. Quiet contemplation helps you find contentment. It's a perfect cycle for redecorating projects in your home. You'll be devoting great energy to family matters. Honor your childhood memories and heritage. Tonight, a long and soothing herbal bath. Aquarius, January 20 through February 18. 5 stars. You're ready to explore and wander. Reflect upon a world map to help intuit the best places for visits once this pandemic is over. There's an urge to be active, not to wait or postpone. Today reminds you to savor the present. Tonight, savoring. Pisces, February 19 through March 20. 4 stars. Today marks a wonderful time to separate the promising from the outmoded with regard to your source of income. You're very progressive in analyzing new economic trends. Good financial news. Tonight, investment clubs and other group activities help you with financial planning. Born today, playwright Jean Giraudoux, 1882, chemist Carl DeGerassi, 1923, actress Winona Ryder, 1971.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.